May it please the court, my name is Scott Shannon. I'm here on behalf of appellant, defendant below, Richard D. Wetzel. With me at council table is my co-counsel, Melissa Carnino. I ask to reserve...
It's our custom when you are introduced to the court to stand. Thank you.
My apologies, Your Honor. I ask to reserve 5 minutes of my argument time for rebuttal. The primary issues presented for the court's consideration in this appeal can be summarized as appellant Wetzel is appealing from a Section 225 action decided by Chancery Court in a decision that is overbroad and made findings on issues not properly before the court and beyond the scope of a 8 Delaware Code Section 225 action. In briefing these issues in March through June, we addressed them piecemeal under the status of the law based on the precedents and authorities that were available at that time. The reply brief was filed on June 20th. On July 18th, this court issued its opinion in the case of Ganger versus TR Investors, LLC, reported at 26A3rd, 180. In my assessment, the court's rulings, particularly on the issues of ratification and the scope of a 225 action in the Ganger decision, are dispositive as to the issues presented on appeal here. We notified the court by correspondence dated November 14th, that we were aware of the Ganger decision and would intend to address Ganger, its impact, and make argument from it during oral argument today. And while I am prepared to review the arguments made in our briefing and present that, with the court's permission, I think our time may be better spent addressing the Ganger decision and how we see that it applies. The complaint filed by appellee plaintiff below Blades requested Chancery Court enter a declaratory judgment on three questions, all based solely on a purported written consent of GLI shareholders that was executed on March 18th of 2010. The procedural problem that this created was that in November of 2009, Blades had noticed and convened a shareholder meeting premised on the assumption that GLI stock issued to minority shareholders, of which there are some 50, was all valid, and Blades then proceeded to solicit proxies from those minority shareholders and to use their stock to elect a board of directors. Subsequently, realizing both that the November 2009 shareholders meeting was not properly noticed and seeking to argue, on the other hand, that the minority shareholders themselves were not valid shareholders of GLI, Blades and the Ohio Company executed the written consent on March 8, 2010, proceeding on the assumption that they were the only two valid shareholders of GLI.
Now, the validity of that consent is central to the 225 Act.
It absolutely is, Your Honor, and that's where the procedural problem comes up, because in executing that written consent, what they purported to do was to validate the actions taken at the invalid November 2009 shareholders meeting and subsequent directors meeting. So, in other words, they went from accepting all of the minority shareholders as valid to, no, we are the only valid shareholders. But the actions that were taken at the invalidly called meeting, including the invalid shareholders and the invalid directors who were elected, we want to adopt those. We want to ratify those actions. So that puts they attempted to put a gloss of validity on an invalid action. And the problem here for Chancery Court, though, was that in order for Chancery Court to determine the issues before it, it had first to rule that the only two shareholders of GLI were Blades and the Ohio Company. However, the only shareholder of those two that was before the court was Mr. Blades himself. There were two minority shareholders amongst the defendants, non-parties to the appeal, Wisehart and Blazer, but there were 45 or more other minority shareholders who held stock certificates of GLI stock who believed that they were valid shareholders who were not parties to this action.
Yeah, but isn't there ample authority that in a Section 225 action, the court can determine the validity of an issue of stock for the sole purpose of deciding whether or not the action that was taken received the proper number of votes, as distinguished from issues of ultimate ownership.
This was an issue that was addressed squarely in Ganger, where the question was the record ownership. The court referred to this as the side opinion.
Well, before you get to that, there is such authority, is there not?
There is, Your Honor.
All right, and isn't that what happened here?
What happened here is Chancery Court went far beyond what was necessary to decide the case before it. In other words, it would be one thing had Chancery Court stated that the only record owners of stock for purposes of voting were Blades and GLI. That was the extent of the finding permitted by this court in Ganger, record ownership. And in terms of beneficial ownership and depriving these other shareholders or ruling on the status
of
their
stock. Well, in the Ganger case, the court actually did explicitly decide issues of beneficial ownership.
And that was an issue, a point on which the Chancery Court was reversed.
Right. But in this case, is there anything in the opinion that that indicates that the court was deciding issues of beneficial stock ownership as distinguished from entitlement to vote?
A plea makes the argument, interestingly, in their brief, that only voting rights were decided.
My question is,
yes.
Where in the opinion is there support for your argument that the Court of Chancery was deciding beneficial ownership?
Page 29 on Chancery Court's November 17, 2010 decision, first paragraph, top of the page, first full sentence, if I may read. The stock purportedly held by minority stockholders. The court has acknowledged the minority stockholders are holding stock. To return, the stock purportedly held by minority stockholders, having never been properly authorized through a valid stock split, is, to borrow a phrase from Starr, void and a nullity. The court then goes on, because the only stockholders of Global Launch with validly issued shares are Blades and the Ohio Company, the other issues in this case need not be reached.
This type of issue has already been resolved in Starr, and this court affirmed that ruling. How is this any different?
The issue in Starr, if I recall correctly, had to do with a stock split where preferred stock was issued in derogation of the rights of the common stockholders. Here what we had was...
It was preferred stock that the person who received it thought had a right to vote, and the determination was that there was no right to vote because the right to vote wasn't included in the language that created that stock in the charter.
Thank you, Your Honor. And that was very specific to the facts in Starr, and again, went to preferred stock and different classifications of stock, voting different classifications of rights as well. Here, only common stock was at issue. The minority shareholders of GLI were not getting any greater or lesser rights than any other stockholders. They were being issued in kind the same stock.
Right. There was no explicit a targeted issue of the right to vote component of the stock in this case. However, what was involved would entail a change of the capital structure, which is something that normally has to be done through a charter amendment.
Without a doubt, Your Honor. And here, the change in the capital structure occurred, we submit, when in the aggregate, some $615,000 invested by the minority shareholders was brought into GLI to fund its operations, in exchange for which the stock was issued to them to evidence their ownership interest in the corporation. So when we're talking about the change of the corporate structure, the Chancery Court did find that if anything, there had been a proper authorization to increase the shares of stock, but not to have a stock split. And I can cite that language from the opinion if it would be helpful to Your Honor. But the Chancery Court did find that there had been a valid...
Well, what I'm struggling to understand...
Yes.
...is, and answer me in a sentence or two if you can, how conceptually this case differs, if at all, from Star Surgical.
In a sentence, Your Honor, to my reading of Star, and I don't presume to question the knowledge of Your Honor who was participated in the decision, as I understand, but to my reading of Star, the dispositive issue was that it was different classifications of stock, and that preferred stock because it is specific, it has limitations, it's in derogation of what are commonly understood as common stock rights that are generally held by all.
In other words, Star involved preferred stock, in this case involves common stock. Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor, that is.
Okay. Let me just ask you one other question. You've got two central arguments here. One goes to the merits of who was entitled to vote, and the other goes to the claim that the court went beyond what it was empowered to do under
right.
225 and decided unnecessary issues. And there are two issues that you are talking about, as I understand it.
Yes.
One is the ultimate beneficial ownership of the minority shareholders. Whether or not the court determined the ultimate beneficial ownership of the stock by the minority shareholders, which you say goes way beyond what the court had the power to do.
Correct.
This is what we've been talking about.
Yes.
But separate and apart from that, very critical language in the opinion relating to how Mr. Wetzel carried out his duties as an attorney. Let's focus on that latter, because I'm not sure what's at stake here. I understand that the language that you're referring to may adversely affect Mr. Wetzel's reputation as an attorney, but does it involve any kind of real financial or legal liability risk?
To the extent that this opinion in any manner is found to have precedential effect, and there is case law that says that in a 225 action, the precedential effect is very narrowly drawn.
No. I'm asking a very concrete question.
Yes.
Here. You know, your argument, at least in this section of your brief,
yes,
says, look, the vice chancellor went way beyond what he was empowered to do. You know, the opinion reads like a legal malpractice opinion.
Yes.
Is your argument that this opinion is in effect adjudicating him liable for legal malpractice, or at least, prejudging that issue?
Yes. Not only on legal.
Okay.
Not
Has there been any legal malpractice action filed?
Yes, Your Honor, there has been.
And you're concerned that this will have some dispositive effect?
I actually brought a copy of the legal malpractice complaint that was filed on October 10th. October 20th. It quotes liberally from this November 17th, 2010 opinion, and is both a breach of fiduciary duty. There's both a breach of fiduciary duty count and a legal malpractice count against Mr. Wetzel, which rely almost exclusively. And there are several pages in the complaint itself, which is nothing but block quotes from this opinion.
Can I take that to be a yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what relief would this court be able to grant in that context that's meaningful?
A reversal of the decision and a holding that is limited to the issues that were properly before Chancery Court for decision in this 225 action.
Well, let's suppose, just so that I can understand where you're going, that we were to affirm on the merits That is, uphold the ruling that the only two shareholders who were entitled to vote were Blades and the Ohio Company. But reverse on the second ground. You're saying that we should be directing the Court of Chancery to rewrite the opinion?
I don't believe that that would be necessary. I realize that that was part of the relief we requested in our argument, too.
Well, but what is it that was that would happen if we were to agree with you that some relief needs to be granted?
Again,
what do we direct the Chancery Court to do?
A direct Chancery Court to withdraw that opinion and instructions to issue an opinion that is limited to the issues properly before it. As an example, if I may, Your Honor, if the finding was that the, and this is where Chancery Court's decision, what it depended upon, that the stock split was invalidly accomplished, once Chancery Court has made that decision, it needs go no further. There is extensive, it read to me as something more than dicta, but less than an adjudication on the merits, about after Blades left the board, many of the decisions made by Mr. Wetzel were suspect, self-interested, and breach of fiduciary obligations. The opinion starts by commenting on Mr. Wetzel's demonstrated lack of knowledge of Delaware law.
Okay, well, Mr. Shannon, and
yes.
I'll stop after this question. What I gather you're arguing is that if we were to do what you ask, and the Court of Chancery were told to rewrite the opinion, that it would have to delete all the adjectives as far as Mr. Wetzel is concerned. But there still would be nouns, wouldn't there? That is, in order to determine how the corporation got to this point, where there was a, an invalid issue of stock or an invalid split, there would have to be some fundamental facts about what Mr. Wetzel did or didn't do in order to determine the issue that is that can be adjudicated.
Well, the only issue for a Chancery Court to opine upon is whether or not the stock split was validly performed. Once that issue is decided, anything about what Mr. Wetzel did after Mr. Blades left the board has no bearing on that. Either the stock split was valid or it was not.
That assumes that the facts that have to be found to justify that initial conclusion are facts unrelated to later breaches of fiduciary duty or any issue involving malpractice or a less than a complete understanding of Delaware law. Isn't that correct?
I respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree. I mean, if the comment about an incomplete understanding of Delaware law may have some relevance to whether or not the stock split was validly performed,
right?
But the facts in the record indicate that clearly that the board voted on the stock split while Blades was still on the board, and while Wetzel did not file the certificate of amendment with the Secretary of State until a week or so after Blades resigned from the board, all of the actions that were necessary or should have been taken to perfect the stock split were done or should have been done prior to Blades leaving the board. There is a complete universe of facts that exist on or before Blades leaving the board, except for the filing of a certificate of amendment, which again was about 2 weeks later, on which Chancery Court could base its opinion that the stock split was not valid. Beyond that, any commentary by the court, we submit respectfully, on fiduciary duty obligations or legal knowledge have no bearing on the narrow issue that was presented. And this court has repeatedly said and reiterated in Ganger that only the issues necessary to a finding of the case presented in a 225 action are proper to be decided in a 225 action.
Okay.
I am close to my five-minute mark for reserve time.
Would you like to reserve the balance now?
I would like to reserve the balance now.
You may. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Steve Browerman of Bayard, PA, and I represent the appellee, Rusty Blades. Joining me at council table from the Morris James firm is Peter Laddick, and from my firm, Vanessa Terradentis. Your Honors, I wanted to start, if I may, with a question that Justice Jacobs asked, and that is, what is the difference between this case and Starr? And although there are certainly factual distinctions, I think as a matter of law, there are no distinctions between this case and the court's finding in Starr. The Court of Chancery below decided a key issue, the validity of the stock issuance, to determine solely which stockholders were entitled to vote in order to determine the validity of the written consent executed by Mr. Blades and the Ohio Company. After reaching that conclusion, the court did nothing further with respect to whatever rights those third-party stockholders may or may not have with respect to the stock. The Court of Chancery's decision is entirely consistent with this court's finding in Genger that limited beneficial ownership. The term beneficial ownership doesn't appear anywhere in the Court of Chancery's opinion. The Court of Chancery in two places explicitly stated that Blades and Global Launch needed to be careful of the price of victory because they now had to explicitly deal with the rights of these third-party stockholders. Those rights were not decided in this case, and the court went out of its way to determine that. Because the Court of Chancery did that, the Court of Chancery limited its opinion simply to the validity of the written consent, which determined, as Mr. Shannon admitted, on the validity of the stock split.
Why is it necessary to address any particular individual's state of knowledge of Delaware law?
I think, Your Honor, there are two reasons. The first reason is because Mr. Wetzel came into the Court of Chancery and argued that what he did was valid, citing Delaware law. That's the first reason. The second reason is that Mr. Wetzel raised equitable defenses below, equitable defenses that he is still arguing today as a reason why the Court of Chancery erred by not considering those equitable defenses, those of which... And the facts, including Mr. Wetzel's knowledge and understanding of Delaware law, his complicity in the problems that Global Launch faced, his credibility as a witness, all impacted the Court of Chancery's determination of those facts. So those are why the Court of Chancery should have and properly did determine whether what Mr. Wetzel did was appropriate. The Court of Chancery's findings were directly in response to arguments Mr. Wetzel made that either the court should disregard well-established Delaware law that says that a stock split must be effected with scrupulous adherence to the standard applying this court's mandate.
Now, you refer to these other investors. None of that other investment money went directly to Global Launch, did it?
I believe, Your Honor, that is an issue that was never fully resolved. I believe the parties have a disagreement. It may be that some of it ultimately came in to Global Launch through the Ohio companies, but the state...
Well, that's much different because, as I understood the record, at least in the Court of Chancery, these investors were getting some Ohio company stock. So to the extent they were giving money to anybody, they were giving it to the Ohio company. What the Ohio company did with it would be an entirely separate issue. But the reason I want you to tell me about this distinction in the record is because if the investors paid the money directly to Global Launch, even if there wasn't a valid stock split, the amount of authorized shares was increased, and Global Launch could have issued new shares to those people. But the briefs and the records seem to suggest no shares were issued by Global Launch based on any direct money coming in from the investors.
I believe, unfortunately, Your Honor, that the record is not as clear as anyone would like on that point. My client certainly...
Well, wouldn't that be important when we're talking about who the shareholders are? If we're not talking about a stock split anymore, and we're talking about an increase in the authorized shares, and we're talking about Global Launch taking money and giving out shares, then we would have additional shareholders, wouldn't we?
If that was validly done, that's correct. That's not what happened here, though, because all of the shares that the other stockholders received were post-split shares, directly transferred from Mr. Blades or the Ohio companies. There was no, according to the testimony in the record below, from both Mr. Wetzel and Mr. Blades' understanding, there were no direct issuances of stock from Global Launch. There was stock that there were certificates that were reflecting stock that was post-split stock that was taken from the Ohio company and Mr. Blades out of their column on the stock ledger and given to new stockholders. So the answer to your Honor's question is no. There are no other. The determination of whether that money came in doesn't impact the Court of Chancery's determination because there were no shares for those stockholders to receive even if they had put in money. The record isn't as clear, although my understanding of the record is that they did not put cash directly into Global Launch. Rather, they made it to the Ohio companies. Unfortunately, the way Mr. Wetzel documented this transaction confused it because you have a private placement memorandum issued by Global Launch, which has the appearance that Global Launch is issuing additional securities rather than a transfer of securities from the Ohio company and Mr. Blades, which is what's reflected on the stock split, excuse me, the stock ledger, and what the testimony showed.
Just to follow up on that, you're saying the minority shareholders got stock not directly from the issuing company, but rather from the Ohio company. But the shares that they received from the Ohio company had been distributed or issued by the issuing company, GLC or whatever, to the Ohio company, and those shares were invalid because they were not properly authorized. Is that correct?
I believe that the answer to your question is yes, and let me just restate that so I'm providing Your Honor with the correct answer. Global Launch initially issued 10 million shares of stock split roughly two-thirds, one-third between the Ohio companies and Mr. Blades. They then attempted, invalidly, to do a stock split in order for the Ohio company to sell its stock, its one-third share, to third-party stockholders. Mr. Wetzel then caused Global Launch to issue new stock certificates to everyone, reducing the Ohio company's stock certificate by the percentage that was given to the third parties the Ohio companies were transferring their stock to, and Mr. Blades' holdings by the proportion that he was allegedly transferring stock to his designees. So I think that's a confusing way of saying yes, but I believe the answer to your question, Your Honor, is yes.
Okay, so everybody, including the Ohio company and Mr. Blades, were holding certificates, and when all was said and done, and the four post-split shares.
That's correct, Your Honor, yes.
But as a legal matter, nobody owned any post-split shares because those shares were invalid.
That's precisely the point, Your Honor, yes. So the only folks...
Right, and as a result, Ohio Company and Blades continue to own their originally issued shares, even though they didn't have a certificate that reflected that.
They may have had a certificate. I don't recall standing here today whether they had turned in their certificate and whether it was canceled. It was indicated as canceled on the stock ledger. But as the Court of Chancery pointed out, the stock ledger was... I think he wrote, hopelessly unreliable. But they were indicated as canceled. But as to what happened to those particular certificates, I don't know standing here today. They may have still held the actual certificate.
Let me just ask you, to turn to the second argument that's been made, in particular the one that focuses on Mr. Wetzel. The concern is that... The way the opinion was drafted, it markedly increased the risk of an adverse malpractice judgment in a different lawsuit because, you know, of the language that was used in the opinion. I gather that your response to questions that were asked either by the Chief Justice or another justice was If that is the case, Mr. Wetzel brought it on himself, and it was necessary for the Vice Chancellor to write the opinion the way he did. Can you put some flesh on those bones? Because that's a pretty abstract answer.
It certainly is, Your Honor, and let me do that. On pages 15 and 16 of Appellant's opening brief, Appellant bullet points a number of statements where he believes the Court of Chancery exceeded its authority and overly exposed Mr. Wetzel to liability. One of those, he stated, is at trial, Mr. Wetzel said he orally gave an undated and unspecified opinions to this effect to himself. And let me put that statement in context. One of the arguments that Mr. Wetzel made at the trial court below was the stock split was valid, and once you get past the stock split, the transfers were valid. There were a number of stockholder agreements that specified certain steps that needed to be completed before a valid transfer could take effect. That one of those was the receipt of an opinion of counsel within a certain time, if the transfer was made within a certain time period of the issuance. There was no evidence that any such opinion was rendered. So there was an argument at trial that Mr. Wetzel never, that the transfers of shares were invalid because there was never an opinion of counsel. And Mr. Wetzel made what the Court of Chancery found to be a bizarre argument that he gave an oral opinion of counsel himself on behalf of the company. And there was a soliloquy in the transcript about how that opinion was given. That was a finding and a statement the Court of Chancery needed to determine that directly related to, and I apologize, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
That directly related to one of the alternative arguments that Mr. Wetzel reached. And most of these statements came into play in response to Mr. Wetzel's equitable arguments.
All right, but let's focus on a different a bit of language in the opinion. And that is that language to the effect that Mr. Wetzel didn't understand anything about Delaware law and yet was, in effect, counseling and generaling a transaction that depended on compliance with Delaware law. It's one thing for the opinion to conclude that that whatever it is that Mr. Wetzel did not comply with the dictates of Delaware law, and it's quite different, is it not, for the opinion to conclude that and add also that Mr. Wetzel didn't really understand Delaware law. It's the latter, either comment or insinuation, that has overtones of malpractice, does it not?
Well, Your Honor, that's certainly...
And if it does, why was it necessary to put that in?
Well, I think it does have overtones of malpractice, but quite frankly, I think there was a risk of a malpractice claim arising from this suit, regardless of whether you mentioned Mr. Wetzel's name at all, because the mistakes that were made were so clearly in violation of Delaware law that it's plain from its face.
I understand. Certainly there is a risk of malpractice, but the argument here is that Mr. Wetzel, you know, is entitled to have his full day in court in that malpractice action and not have the malpractice action predetermined in a Delaware action, which is on really a different issue.
No, and he certainly does. And I don't believe any of these findings are binding, have any collateral estoppel effect, or really relate to the claims.
Why would that be? Why would there be no collateral estoppel as on a finding that he essentially committed malpractice?
Well, I don't believe, Your Honor, that the court found that he committed malpractice. The statement that we're discussing states that he lacked experience in Delaware law. Lacking experience in Delaware law does not equate with a malpractice claim because lawyers have an obligation to educate themselves. So simply stating that he lacks experience in Delaware law does not equate to a finding that he committed malpractice.
But a little bit further down, the court says, so pervasive were the departures from expected norms in the execution of important corporate transactions. And that directly relates to what Wetzel didn't do or did incorrectly. If I were counsel, I would consider that pretty significant statement of malpractice.
Well, Your Honor, I absolutely agree. I think it is a significant statement. I think from the court's findings, you can conclude and base a malpractice action and justify a malpractice action against Mr. Wetzel. But in that subsequent action, you're still going to have to present evidence of the malpractice that he committed and prove by the appropriate burden, depending on which state you're in. Now, that malpractice action was filed in Delaware and is pending before the chancellor. So I think some of these concerns are somewhat muted by the fact that the same judge will be hearing the same facts.
Malpractice actions filed in the Court of Chancery?
Yes, because it's not simply a malpractice. It's oversimplification to say it's a malpractice action.
It's a dependent claim to the breach of fiduciary duty.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
let's go back to a minute to your earlier point about one of the reasons, at least as you posit it, that the chancellor spoke to these arguably extraneous factual findings was because there were equitable claims. And we know the maxim that in order to achieve equity, one must do equity. Is it your position that the comments he made were designed to make findings of fact to establish why Mr. Wetzel was not entitled to equity in the face of his equity claim?
I think that's precisely what he did, Your Honor, and we don't have to speculate about that because the Court of Chancery tells us explicitly. He adds a line, even if I were entitled to weigh equity against law here, even if my equitable heartstrings, I think the words he used, were plucked, I don't find that Mr. Wetzel's entitled to an equitable award. I still wouldn't find in favor of the defendants because Mr. Wetzel, in particular, did all these things wrong. So I think Your Honor is absolutely correct that the reason he reached most of these was because he was addressing arguments that Mr. Wetzel made. And I'd like, if I may, to say Mr. Shannon said when he was standing here that once the court decided the validity of the stock split, he didn't need to go any further, and that was error. But appellant's first argument on appeal accepts that the stock split was invalid, but still argues that there was a de facto stock split based on all these extraneous facts, based on all these other factors. Now, appellant can't have it both ways. Either the stock split, the validity of the stock split decided the issue and ground one for appeal is gone, or the Court of Chancery needed to address additional arguments and he had a right to do it, and then argument two is gone. And it's not inconsistent to lose both of those appeals, but to make simultaneously their first argument on appeal that even if the stock split is invalid because they didn't follow the statutory requirements, they still win because there are all these other stockholders and everyone intended there to be stockholders, that it was absolutely appropriate and indeed necessary under their own argument for the Court of Chancery to review these other decisions.
Well, how do they fit within a 225 action? All these other equitable arguments.
I think the equitable arguments related to which stockholders were entitled to vote and the threshold question of whether there were any stockholders in light of the invalid stock split other than Mr. Blades and the Ohio Company that were entitled to vote. So I think that relates directly to the scope of the 225 action to the extent, and one point I want to make so I ensure I don't waive it, is some of the equitable defenses were not raised or were not raised clearly. There were some that were raised, but not all of them below. And so I just want to make sure I don't waive that point by conceding that they were. So we don't think the equitable defenses were proper. We think the level of treatment the court gave them below, which was secondary and in the interest of completeness, was appropriate. We don't think they warranted a full and complete analysis, and the court below didn't undertake it. But to answer Your Honor's question, Justice Ridgely, they directly relate to the defendants below's and appellant here's equitable arguments that because Mr. Blades had some degree of knowledge, and that's a disputed fact below, and was aware that some monies came from somewhere, that because he had some unidentified knowledge that there were these other stockholders who had rights that the Court of Chancery was stepping on.
So even if they were outside the scope of a 225 action, it was Wetzel that brought this into the case anyway.
That's precisely correct, Your Honor.
Just one maybe technical question that I'm unclear about. Now, I understand that the primary attack on the stock split was a de jure attack. That is, as a de jure matter, this was flat out invalid. I understand that the response to that was, even if it is de jure invalid, there are we have equitable defenses that I guess would cause the court not to invalidate. Then you have the de facto stock split argument, and I'm not sure whether the de facto stock split argument is an alternative legal argument or whether it's part of the equitable defenses or how it fits. That's my confusion.
And I apologize if I interrupted, Your Honor. That's my confusion as well, but I don't think it's necessary to resolve the confusion, and the reason is there is no de facto stock split. This court and 20 years of precedent is very clear that the only way to effect a stock split is by scrupulous adherence to Section 242. The only case they rely – I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, the reason I ask is that if the de facto stock split argument is something separate and apart from the equitable defenses, then that goes – that may factor into the degree to which it was or wasn't necessary for the Vice Chancellor to address Mr. Wetzel's shortcomings specifically.
No, and let me address that, Your Honor. I think – it is unclear as presented whether it's a separate argument or part, at least to me, part of an equitable argument. But I think the way to resolve that confusion is it's the de facto stock split is not necessary to resolve any of the equitable claims. It's not an equitable element of any of those claims. The Court of Chancery below and this Court reassessing de novo can determine whether the facts as the Court of Chancery found them, unless they were clearly erroneous, could meet any one of those equitable defenses if, ignoring the threshold point, that you could compare law and equity. So I think it is appropriate for the Court of Chancery to treat it as a separate argument, which would explain, in addition, why the Court of Chancery went beyond this. But I think there's a policy issue and implication, and it's a question, Justice Jacobs, that you asked Mr. Shannon. And that is, let's say you're right, and we agree with you, that the Court of Chancery said things that maybe the court shouldn't have said. What exactly are we supposed to do as an appellate court? And I think that's a very difficult question for this court to grapple with, because obviously this court cannot be in the business of policing every single sentence in every single opinion that all of the courts below it write. So while I think it is a stretch to say the Court of Chancery went beyond, and I don't believe that's what Mr. Shannon argued. Mr. Shannon said it was something north of dicta but south of relevance. I'm not sure what that is, but for this court to remand with an instruction to the Court of Chancery to rewrite the opinion in a way that doesn't offend Mr. Wetzel is, I think, somewhat of an impractical, or rather than offend, that doesn't expose Mr. Wetzel to potentially additional liability in the context of this case, where Mr. Wetzel's mistakes were pervasive and then compounded by the fact that he came to Delaware pro se below and defended those actions. I think that factored into the court's determination. This should not have been a surprise to Mr. Wetzel. This was a expedited 225 case that the court took 2 months in between purposefully, in between the conclusion of argument and the issuance of the opinion, to after strongly suggesting that the parties consider an alternative resolution because the opinion might not be favorable to Mr. Wetzel. And so I think under the circumstances here, given what Mr. Wetzel did, the court did not exceed its authorization, properly decided issues that were central to the 225 action or raised as defenses.
Just one other factual question. There isn't now pending a malpractice claim against Mr. Wetzel?
No, Your Honor, there is now pending a malpractice claim that is a claim before the Court of Chancery collateral to a breach of fiduciary duty.
So it's not a claim in a court of law outside of Delaware?
It is not a claim in a court of law outside of Delaware. Your Honors, I see I'm out of time, so unless there are any further questions, I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much.
I am stunned to hear that in making legal argument that the court does not accept that that is, at least as I understood the argument my brother at the law just advanced, that that is in itself somehow indicative of legal malpractice, because if that's the case, I have frequently committed malpractice before this court. And that is, as I understand, a plea's position. The argument that they are making to support the that those findings, those opinions by the chancellor in his opinion, that Mr. Wetzel made, for example, equitable arguments that Chancery Court rejected, and because of that, it was proper for Chancery Court to comment at length on his lack of knowledge of Delaware law. As a matter of fact,
well, let me interrupt you for a second. The concern, if I'm not mistaken, is that language in this opinion will have some negative effect on another claim.
Correct.
Against Mr. Wetzel. Shouldn't you be presenting all these arguments as needed in that proceeding, as opposed to asking this court to delete findings or have the trial court delete findings, or for us to say that those findings are inconclusive or something like that?
Oh.
You know, you've got information, a written statement, an opinion that says what it says, and the other side is going to try and argue that that proves something, and you're going to argue no, it doesn't. So why should we be taking this up?
We will make those arguments at the appropriate time. Why it's in good faith it's appropriate for this court to address is because of the very strict limitations this court has drawn, most recently in the Ganger decision, on the proper scope of a 225 action, and limiting to those findings which are necessary to decide the issue before it on the validity of the election or the shareholder action, as may be the case. Therefore, anything that goes beyond what is necessary for the court to find in a 225 action is an error of law. It is in excess of the Chancery Court's authority to go beyond what is necessary. It's a repeated admonition by this court.
But is it a reversible error? I mean, if we uphold the Vice Chancellor, now Chancellor's decision on the merits of the claim, which is the stock split, and the only remaining issue is whether it was proper or improper or exceeded the scope of the 225 action for the court to describe Mr. Wetzel in language that had malpractice overtones, even if that was not necessary, it wouldn't change the result, because on the merits, you know, under my hypothetical, we will have affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Is it reversible error? It's for this court to decide that question. And the argument
give us guidance.
And the argument that we have made, yes, it is. I have read cases, I've been involved in cases that have come before this court, and where the end result is the same, or at least indistinguishable from what was obtained below in the trial court. However, the reasoning of how the court arrived at that result is very different. This court frequently sees issues that the trial court didn't, and again, may get to the same point or a substantially similar point through a different path.
I think you mentioned earlier that this malpractice breach of fiduciary suit had been filed in Delaware recently.
That's correct.
In the Court of Chancery?
Yes.
And has that been assigned to anyone yet?
Chancellor Chandler, or Chancellor Strine, Your Honor.
And Chancellor Strine did the opinion in this case?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if we say in disregard what you wrote, how is that going to work as a practical matter?
There will at least be not only necessitated, but there will be a full and fair trial on those issues. and a full and fair opportunity for Mr. Wetzel to present the evidence as to the fiduciary duty claims and the legal malpractice claims, which we submit have been prejudged in the context of this 225 action.
But that is a remedy that would be available or an argument in that other case, correct?
Unless the inclination of the chancellor is to find that collateral estoppel applies to prevent the re-argument of those issues which he has already ruled upon and decided in this opinion.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Thank you, court.